Very often I carry this stand over here. You will have noticed to come to some final reading or something in my talk, but by the time I'm 10 minutes into my talk, I never make it back to this. We'll see what happens today. I really am so grateful that Greg played that chant today, that invocation to God. It's just so beautiful, and usually when we hear it only as an opening to the chants we're about to do and to our meditation. But because I happen to live right next door to Greg, yesterday I heard him practicing that chant. Of course, I didn't know he was practicing it for today. But I was so happy sitting in my house listening to it. I thought, wow, look at that. God is just sending me the perfect music for this talk. And then here he is playing it this morning. And it really, it says it all. Thou art my mother, my father, my friend, my beloved. Thou art my wisdom, my wealth. Thou art the light of all lights. It just says exactly what this reading says, which is that God is everything. God is the doer of everything. We would have no wisdom, no wealth, nothing, were it not for God's presence. We are God. And of course, we forget that. Swami says somewhere that we're all born with a predisposition towards superficiality. And he says, but really, how could we not be? We come in from the minute we come in. We have to live on the surface because we immediately have to start taking care of ourselves. We're just drawn by our senses. We have to figure out this body, how to get it moving, how to coordinate it. We have to figure out how to feed it. We have to develop a language and then perfect that language. All these things that take us out. He's very, very empathic and compassionate in some of his expanded writings about this reading. Because he says, really just right out, he says, let's face it, the path to God is like an obstacle course. And it is. And he also says, which is very right, although truth is absolute, thou art my mother, my father, my wisdom, my wealth, the path to get there can be quite convoluted. So it really raises the question, how can we find our way there, step by step by step, with those truths that make sense to each of us, wherever we are on this path? As soon as I read this reading, I had the memory of a little encounter that I had with Swamiji many years ago. And first I was amazed how powerful these stories, these encounters, different moments on our path can be. They can just look like nothing in the moment, but here it is probably 10 years later, and the story just came to me. And it came to me with a greater understanding of the wisdom than I had in the moment. But Swamiji was down here in Palo Alto, and we were having some big luncheon or event out on the green in our community. And of course, Swami was the guest of honor. That's what we were all waiting for, Swami to come and speak to us. But he got very sick. He actually got really very sick. He had a very high fever and shaking chills, and he was up in his bedroom in David Nash's home. And I kept wondering if I should offer to go up and see if there was anything I could do for him, because as most of you know, but I'll just say it for those who don't, I'm a physician, but I had never taken care of Swamiji. And finally I said to Asha, do you think I should go up there? And she said, let me ask Swami. So she came back and she said, yes, Swamiji would like you to come up. So I went up and I talked to him, and I could feel he had a very high fever. And I said to him, you know, Swamiji, it would be really good right now if we could get your fever down. So what I'd like to do is I'd like a few of us to take some nice, cool rags and put them on the back of your head and your neck and around your head, of course, wanting to just bring his fever down. And he was like this, just laying there. And I said, Swamiji, how does that sound? And he said, utterly ghastly. Well, you know, you certainly don't want to be doing anything to your great spiritual teacher after those words. But I looked at him and I said, I understand, sir, but will you still allow it? And he said, if I have to. So a few of us who were there got these rags and we put them on Swamiji, and sure enough, his fever started coming down a little bit. But it was only about, I don't know, 30 minutes till the talk. And I was in my head saying to myself, no way. No way is this man going to get out there to give a talk. I mean, maybe this was 10 years ago, but that still would have made Swamiji in his later 70s. And he was frail at that time. He was already frail. Little did we know what was going to happen in the next 10 years of his life. I don't think any of us would have predicted that in that moment. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to say to him, Swamiji, I really don't think you can go and give this talk, because I didn't want to be the source of any contractive or negative energy. And there were stories that I had heard about when people had mentioned to Swamiji that he might not be able to do something, whatever it was, over the years. But I really didn't think he could do it. So I said to him, you know, Swamiji, if you don't think you, if, or feel that you could go and give this talk, everybody would understand. We would really understand. And his eyes popped open, and he said to me, I can't go and give this talk, Shanti, but God can and God will. And it was just with so much force and power. Everything in the room changed. And you know, he went out in about 30 minutes. He gave, of course, a beautiful talk. Again, he was frail, so I don't know how much anybody realized how sick he was in the moment. But he gave such a beautiful talk, and then he went back up, and he got into bed, and he was sick again. And it was just such a powerful moment. But when it came into my head yesterday around this talk, it was even more profound than I remembered it, because he just handed me this lesson in that moment. I can't, Shanti, but God can and will. It was just, it's the whole reading. It is so clear that we are so often limited by our perception of what is, and what a false notion that is, that we would think that the limit of our ability to perceive something, in fact, is the limit of what is there. And it's just simply never true for most of us, never. It reminded me of a cartoon that I saw that went around, so maybe many of you saw it also, of a bird in a cage with its little claws around the bars and its beak coming through. And first you're drawn into that little bird's face, but then in a minute you realize there's no other bars on the cage, just the bars that the bird's holding on to, thinking he'd like to get out. That which we think binds us and holds us to the reality that we see is really, it's never it. We are only bound by the limits of our ego's ability to perceive anything. And what this reading says, and it says it so clearly, is that our goal in life is to become progressively more and more and more soul related, so that we expand into what our souls know to be true, not what our ego thinks is true. We just recently finished a class in death and dying, a four-week class. It was quite profound. And the first hour of the class was that those who came would share stories, if they chose to, about experiences they were in the midst of or had had about people in their lives who had died. And again, it's just, it's very profound. I would say to you, listen to the talks that were given after. They were good, but this first hour, which we intentionally did not record so people could be free to speak, was really such an open-hearted and deep sharing on the part of so many, and it moved us all. But there was a story that somebody told the last week, which was just this past week, about he had just taken a trip to visit his family, and during that trip, one of his sisters had told him the story of what happened when their father died. I'm sure this was prompted by him talking a little bit about this class. But she told the story that the father, who was in an automobile accident, and I think that automobile accident, he said, triggered some major medical thing, but he never said what, and it doesn't matter. So the father was very sick, but he was absolutely expected to live. Everybody just thought he would pull through and live. But then he died. In fact, he died not long after the accident. The sister now related, and this was many years ago, but the sister now related this story to the man in the class, that she was at home in Southern California. The father was not there. And she had either a dream or she knew it was a vision. I can't remember. But in that dream, a band of angels came to her. She said they were beautiful angels. And they were singing to her. And the father was there with them, but he was not an angel. And she was telling her brother now. She said, I knew that Dad died when I was having that dream. I knew that. And he was saying to us, and in fact, when she woke up, she got a call that her father had died, and she corroborated this story that the father had died right during the time where she was having that dream. And of course, those stories always grab us. They always feel phenomenal in some ways. But it came to me, and I said it in the class, that the more we expand spiritually, the more we get beyond what our ego tells us it knows to be the truth about so many things, the less those stories would amaze us. Because all of us in that room, and probably many of us in this room, know that the angels are always there. That those realities that feel so phenomenal in any given moment in our life are always true. It's just that we lack the ability in the moment to see it because we're living in terms, again, of our ego's reality. And as I said before, Swamiji said, of course we are. Ours is to find out, to ask the question, how can we expand beyond that? There's a wonderful story in Autobiography of a Yogi of Swami Pranabananda. And he was the saint with two bodies. That's the chapter for those of you who have read the autobiography. And in it, Master Yogananda goes to see him when he, in this story that Master relates in the book, when he's 12 years old. He goes to meet this Swami because he had heard great things about him. And this Swami tells him the story of how he met his guru. And Pranabananda, I don't know why I'm having so much trouble with that, but Pranabananda's guru was Lahiri Mahashaya, this man on my right on the altar. And he said that for many years, it so happened he worked for Master's father at the railroad, for the Indian Railroad. So he would work all day. And then he would go home, and every night he would meditate 8 hours. Every night, he and a friend. For years and years and years, he meditated 8 hours a night. And he said he had some very profound experiences, but there was always a veil, this thin veil that was there, that would keep him from feeling that he had merged with God. So one night he went to see his guru, Lahiri Mahashaya, and he said, I want you to help me. I want you to give me this experience of being one with God. I can't quite get there on my own. And Lahiri Mahashaya said, there's nothing I can do. You have to meditate more deeply. And Pranabananda, not to be dissuaded, said to him, I'm sitting here experiencing God in human form. I know you are all that is divine, manifested yourself in this form. I know that you could lift this veil for me. So Lahiri Mahashaya thought for a while, meditated for a while, and then he said to him, now you can go home and meditate. He said, I have interceded with Brahma. Brahma, who's the creator of the universe. And Pranabananda went home then and meditated and had the experience that he was waiting for all of his life. Those experiences that can only be given to us by one who has experienced it, who is it. We can't get there on our own, nor, as Swami said in the reading, Jesus was not saying to be greater than the Pharisees, because the Pharisees were, maybe even many of them, doing good work, but doing good work, again, from a place of ego-centeredness. Jesus is saying in the reading, and this story relates, we have to get to God. We have to find our way back there. As Yogananda says, the only purpose in life, the only reason we're here, is to find God. And he says, we already have all of the necessary tools. But with such beauty, because we have these great masters behind me, just like Pranabananda did. We have these masters. We can call on them. We can say, show us the way. Help us find our way down this convoluted path to all that is, so that we can find that true joy. Master, Swamiji, everybody has said to us over and over, everybody wants the same thing in life, to find love and to avoid pain. What is pain? We have to ask ourselves, because it's interesting, the title of this reading, How High Do We Aspire? What does it even mean to aspire? Never mind what we're aspiring to. Aspire means, or the pain in life means, all of those moments where we're moving in terms of our ego. All of the moments where we forget to be soul-oriented, inspired, attuned. Every time we fall short of that, no matter in what way, no matter what it is, we feel pain. There's nobody else who's causing our pain. There's nobody else who's trying. God certainly doesn't want us to be in pain. God certainly doesn't want us to suffer. This happens for us when we forget what it is we're here to do. When we forget to keep reaching towards our own soul call, if you will, towards the soul that will take us. And we don't have to be right there in samadhi. How many of us are going to have experiences like Pranabananda did? We know what the goal is. We know the goal is pure bliss, but there's a good chance that many of us in this room won't have the experience. But as long as we are focused in that direction, as long as we are inviting God in, that's the beauty of this invocation, then these masters can enter and they can take charge of our life. They literally, though, this is the truth. This is not a sweet way of speaking about what the masters do. They have the ability to come right into our astral or energetic spine and change us if we call to them over and over to come in. If we give them the path to enter, they can do that. You remember, Swami tells this story. He's told it many times, but it's in the path, where there was a group of the monks sitting around talking. I don't write this minute. Remember what they were talking about. But he said, suddenly, Master looked at all the monks and he said, "You see how I've changed, Walter?" And it hit Swamiji, who was feeling himself that he had come a long way. That Master, he had given Master permission. He had opened himself, as Asha was saying the other night during our celebration of the anniversary of Swamiji's passing and what his life was like. He gave him unconditional love and unconditional obedience. Enter and take charge of my life. He said that, and Master was able to. And that is what we need to do. There's a book that I read some years ago when it came into my mind yesterday. I ordered it again. It's a very beautiful book. It's an old book. It's the autobiography of Anwar el-Sadat. And most of you, I'm sure, remember he was the president of Egypt. But before he was the president of Egypt, he was... he was born into a Muslim family, and he lived during a time where there was still British rule in Egypt, and he was one of the people who were fighting against British rule. He became very political in his early life, and during that time he was arrested, and he was put in jail, and he spent a long time in jail, and he says in this book that it was some of the hardest time in his life. He was not treated well in jail. He was often in solitary confinement. But he said during that time, and this is not unlike other books, other lives that we've heard about, that we've talked about, the sisters from, what's the name of the book? I'm there. The Hiding Place, yeah, thank you. Or the woman who wrote about the Rwandan Holocaust, Left to Tell. These are very similar stories where people are put in situations where everything they think they know to be true, all of the rules that they've lived by all of their life, are not serving them, no matter how smart they were, no matter how strong-willed they were, no matter how much they thought they had to bring, nothing serving them under these dire circumstances. So he's in jail, and he starts to pray. And he prays, and he prays, and he starts feeling uplifted. And he notices that he's in pain when he's struggling with what to do about the British or about his jailers. And he feels relief when he prays. And then one day, he says, he has a profound experience. Literally, he says, a ray of light comes into his cell, and he follows that ray, and in the light that expands at the end of that ray, he sees that there is one God for all of us, no matter what religion we are, no matter what our beliefs are. And then, he says, he sees even more expansively that we are all that light. He has that experience. And for the next 8 months in solitary confinement, he just stays in deep communion with God. And when he comes out, ultimately, he becomes the president of Egypt. And many of you may remember that he is the man who fought for a peace treaty with Israel, which many years later became a reality. And I realized when that book came back to me, here we are. We have been sent this ray of light through these masters, and that it is our job to tune into that ray as deeply as each of us can, wherever we are, over and over, and try, like he did, just to follow that ray back to its source. Will we be confused at times? Of course we will. That's why Swamiji said we are so drawn to live on the surface. And we tend to cling to our doubts, our fears, the ways that we're sure we're right, to all that we think we are. And yet, if we got honest, we would see what pain that brings us. And we would see that every time we turn towards the light, the ease we feel in our hearts. The other night in one of these classes, Asha told a story that was just so beautiful to me. It just puts in words a tool that we can all use, and I want to share that story with you. She said there was a young man who was a mathematician, and there were a couple of mathematicians who became self-realizationists, so I don't know if one of them is this person, but it really doesn't matter. And she said before he called himself an atheist, so he didn't even believe in God, but he loved mathematics. He just loved mathematics. And he realized that when the answer was right in the mathematical problem, when it was correct, that everything felt beautiful and peaceful was not harmonious. Beautiful and harmonious. And isn't it just that way? I mean, when you've solved a math problem and you get it, and the answer comes out, there's such a letting go. I mean, of course, this man was already an expanded being. Who would think of that? It was so beautiful to hear about math that way. Beautiful and harmonious when the answer was correct. And then he was able to extrapolate from that, that so many times in his life, things did not feel beautiful and harmonious. So he started questioning himself about the answers he had come up with in life. There is no God, there is nothing beyond me, however he was thinking that or holding that. And it came to him that that answer must not be correct because there was no beauty and no harmony. And I just love that story. I get the feeling that that story will help me check in with myself. Swamiji used to say, his litmus test was his inner peace. Are we on the right road? Are we heading in the right direction? Are we making good decisions for ourselves? Are we remembering that God is the doer? Like our reading today about that beautiful humility that is self-forgetfulness, little self-forgetfulness and self-honesty. Because when we're headed in that direction, when we're living by those truths, even though we may not have made it all the way back to that knowing, that ultimate true knowing, that we are one with God, it will feel peaceful. It will feel beautiful. It will feel harmonious. That's our goal. That's where we're going. That's exactly why we have to keep invoking the presence of the divine so that they can come in and change us. And they don't necessarily change us from here to there. They change us in our next step. Each of us has our own next step. The more we can find ourselves praying to God, calling on God, invoking his presence, the more we will find ourselves with those feelings. I want to end today with this last, I don't know how many of you have read this book, Letters by a Modern Mystic by Frank Laubach. He was a missionary, Christian missionary, who lived in the early 1900s. He went to the Philippines to do his work. And he was in so much pain, another story which you can read in this, but he was in so much pain, he felt so alone, so lonely, like he had such an impossible task that he turned more towards God than even he as a missionary ever knew was possible. And he kept a diary, and this is his diary, which his son later published. And every entry is filled with God's wisdom. He made it a practice to try and stay attuned to God every moment of every day. And he developed different techniques and different practices, really very much like what we've been talking about today. But you can see what an expansive, high, loving, extraordinary being this man was. And here is the last paragraph of his book. He says, "Here is something we can share with all people in the world. They cannot all be brilliant or rich or beautiful. They cannot all even dream beautiful dreams like God gives some of us. They cannot all enjoy music. Their hearts do not all burn with love. But everybody can learn to hold God by the hand and rest. And when God is ready to speak, the fresh thoughts of heaven will flow in like a crystal spring. Everybody rests at the end of the day. What a world gain if everybody could rest in the waiting arms of the Father and listen until he whispers."